So Far from the Bamboo Grove by Yoko Kawashima Watkins, Chapter 4. Hideo, working with three friends from Nanam, was packing assembled machine guns into thick, metal-lined wooden boxes. He had been at the munitions factory 5 days. Now Soichi straightened up and said, "Let's take a break." This meant a trip to the restroom for a cigarette. Hideo did not smoke. "Go ahead," he said to Sachoi, Makoto, and Shinzo. Just as the three disappeared into the restroom, Korean communist soldiers burst into the factory. There was a terrified rush of workers to cover, though the great factory space offered almost none. Hideo instinctively dove into the big empty box that lay on its side before him. While hiding in the box, he could look out and see some of the workers. He saw Yasuo, his classmate, grab one of the machine guns, stuff it with bullets, fire. The soldiers fired back. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Yasuo fell, blood streaming. Someone at the side threw something heavy, one of the boxes, at the soldiers. Again the enemy machine gun fire. Now there was the sound of people falling all around Hideo. The blast of the machine gun overpowered his ears. Farther and farther back he squeezed, made himself smaller and smaller, and held his breath. There was silence, an eerie silence. "Don't move, we shoot," the commanding voice spoke in poor Japanese. A Korean, Hideo thought. "Line up," the voice commanded. There were reluctant footsteps towards the front of the room. "Hands up." Hideo's heart almost failed. Who had been killed? Who had surrendered? All of those students, many not bright enough to be accepted by Japan's Imperial Army, but still a good group, working hard for their country, trying their best to live with humor through the dark days of separation from their families. And Soichi, Makoto, and Shinzo in the restroom. Surely the soldiers would look there. The opening of the box Hideo was hiding in faced the washroom door. Perhaps they would see him too. "March, outside," the voice was commanding. "We'll get this ammunition after we deliver the prisoners. Check all the bodies. If they're still breathing, shoot." "Yes, sir." Hideo edged himself forward. Yasuo's body was so close he could touch it, and he leaned out cautiously and smeared some of the blood streaming from his friend on his own face, his hands, and his clothes. Then he backed into the box. There was the tramp of feet as soldiers and prisoners left the factory, but other soldiers were moving about. One came so close that all Hideo saw were his boots. Hideo closed his eyes and lay down as if dead. "Da-da-da-da-da," went a machine gun. Someone had still been alive. The soldier before Hideo kicked Yasuo's body. Then he saw Hideo's arm, and he kicked it. With the tip of his machine gun, he poked in at Hideo's face and sighed. Hideo lay as dead. The man went toward the washroom. Hideo heard the door kicked open. He held his breath. "No one in here, sir," the soldier reported. "All the others dead." "Lock the doors," he was told. "Bring dynamite and blast the building as soon as the ammunition is moved out." Hideo heard the commander and the last soldiers leave the room. Still, he stayed motionless. The factory door was slammed. Silence. He waited, staring at Yasuo's body. He heard no sound. Cautiously, he crept out from the box and over the body of Yasuo. There were bodies everywhere. Sick, terrified, he crawled among the bodies and the blood, stopping to listen. He reached the washroom door and pushed with his hand to open it. The rusty hinges squeaked. "Makoto," Hideo whispered. No response. There were four toilets, all the doors reaching to the floor, all closed. Hideo stood up. "Soichi, Shinzo, Makoto, it's me, Hideo," he whispered. The third toilet door opened slightly. Makoto peeked out. "You, alive," he gasped. Soichi and Shinzo came from the same cubicle, shaking, their faces ghostly white. "We heard the machine guns," said Shinzo, his lips trembling. "We hid together. They never looked. Who got killed?" "Yasuo was killed right in front of me," Hideo told them. "I don't know who else. They're going to blow up the building. We have to get out." Makoto peered cautiously from the window. "They're making the captured ones walk toward the street. They're pointing machine guns at them." Stealthily, they crept to their bunk room next to the washroom. They crammed belongings into their rucksacks. Then they went back to the washroom, and carefully, slowly, so as not to make a sound, they pushed the window open. The soldiers' backs were turned. One by one, the boys jumped out and ran around the building toward the mountain. They had not gone far when they heard the explosion. They turned and watched the factory exploding into the air. Hideo thought of Yasuo. "It's almost noon," he said, looking at his watch. "If we take the mountain path now, we can be home by early morning." They began walking. Suddenly, Hideo wondered what had happened to his mother and sisters. He walked faster and faster, the others following. They walked until they were so weary they had to stop, and Makoto said, "Hey, I'm hungry. Does anyone have any food?" They all searched their sacks. Mother had packed only 6 days' rations for Hideo, as he had expected to go home the next afternoon for the weekend. so he only had some strips of fish and dried biscuits. They sat on the roots of a tree and shared what little he had. "What time is it?" Makoto asked.
5 o'clock,
Hideo answered. "I'm still hungry," said Shinzo. "Let's look for mushrooms," Makoto suggested.
"Yes, rusted mushrooms are good," Sochi agreed.
Hideo said, "Look, my friends, let's look for mushrooms as we walk. Every moment is precious." At dawn, they reached Hideo's home, our home, which stood in its bamboo forest at the edge of the village.
"What the hell?" yelled Hideo.
The main entrance door had been burst open. The service entrance door stood wide open. They rushed into the house.
"Mother!" Hideo called.
Makoto surveyed the desolation before them. "The Korean communist troops have been here," he said.
"I'm going to my house," Shinzo cried.
"Let's meet at Soichi's house later," Hideo called after them. He was shocked at the ransacking of his home. He examined the rooms carefully. The hanging scroll painting in the receiving room had been slashed to pieces. Closet doors stood open, their contents pulled out. Fur coats, hats, and his sister's muffs had been stolen, except for a tiny fur coat lying on the floor. "Little ones," Hideo thought, and picked it up. Holding it in one arm, he continued to check the rooms. The phonograph radio was gone. A collection of classical records lay scattered on the floor. Kimono drawers were empty. He saw the treadle sewing machine. Why had the robbers not taken this? Probably because they did not know how to use it. The machine was covered, as always when not in use, with a black velvet cloth, but a rice bowl sat perched on top. Strange, Hideo thought. Mother never left anything on top of her machine. He went up to the machine, and then he saw Mother's note in script writing beneath the bowl. He read, "Honorable son, we must leave. We shall be waiting for you at the railroad station in Seoul." The note was dated he had left for the factory. And, he observed, it was written in the cursive style, so that no one who did not know calligraphy could read it. He was putting it in his pocket when he saw that Mother's savings book had been with it under the rice bowl. They must have left in haste, he thought, and he took the savings book. He went to his own room. Whoever had entered here had liked what he possessed. The wall clock, ski shoes, radio, collections of wooden tops he used to play with on the ice, fountain pens, his kimonos, as well as his formal attire, were all gone. His desk drawers had been opened and left in a mess. In the kitchen, he found cookies in the cupboard and rice in the rice bin. He gathered them all into his rucksack. He stuffed in an aluminum cooking pot, candles, and matches. There was a small barrel next to the rice bin where Mother kept pickled plums, and he put as many into his lunchbox as it would hold and wrapped the box in a dish towel. He filled his canteen with water from the kitchen pump. Then he went back to his own room to gather underwear, socks, and a sweater that had not interested the enemy soldiers. His overcoat was nowhere to be seen. In the bathroom, he hastily washed his bloody face. "I must go," he was thinking now. "They may come back to finish stealing our belongings." He took a bar of soap and a bath towel. Then he rolled the tiny fur coat in his blanket and tied the blanket on top of his already full rucksack. Out of habit, he closed and locked the service entrance door. There was no way of locking the main entrance, for it was broken, and he wished he had time to nail a board across the opening. He headed for the narrow bamboo path when suddenly he turned and ran back to the house. He rushed into the family room and picked up an old family photo album he had remembered seeing. Carrying it under his arm, he left the house behind. He looked at his watch. It was 9:15 a.m. The sun was above the bamboo trees now, and carrying his heavy bundle made him hotter. He hurried to Sochi's house, meeting no one on the street and feeling the silence ominous. Makoto and Shinzo were already at Sochi's. Makoto was sobbing. Shinzo's and Sochi's parents had fled south where their relatives lived, but Makoto's aged parents were dead. An only child, he had no place to go. "Don't you have any relatives at all?" Hideo asked. "Not in Korea," Makoto sniffed back tears. "I want to go with you. They are killing Japanese. I'm scared." "You can," said Hideo, "but we cannot flee from this town in Japanese student clothes." They looked at each other. "What are we going to do?" asked Makoto, still crying. Hideo snapped his fingers. "I know. Let's go to my family's friends, the Lees. They have been working for my family faithfully for years. Even though they are Koreans, they are not communists. They'll lend us some clothes." When they found the bodies of Mr. and Mrs. Lee beginning to decay in the summer heat, the four students at first were speechless. The stench assailed their nostrils. They had thought Koreans would be safe. Then Hideo yelled in anger, "Damn them! My home was ransacked. The valuables were stolen. Now the communists slaughter good people." Hideo sobbed. "Let's borrow some clothes and get out of here," yelled Sochi. They changed into Korean clothes. They rolled their student uniforms in their blankets. There was no map to lead them south, so they decided to follow the railroad tracks. But they had walked all night without sleep, so now they went up on the hill near the Lee's house,
crawled into the bushes, and slept until evening came. Their walking journey began. If they had to speak, they spoke in the Korean language. They slept during the day for fear they would be discovered by the Korean Communist Army. Also, it was cooler to walk through the night. When they came across vegetable fields, they dug up whatever they could find, simply shook the dirt off, and ate the vegetables raw to save their own food supplies. They sucked the juices from wild plants. They devoured wild carrots and any tomatoes they found, for the heat made them thirsty. They'd been walking now for 10 days. Their canteens were empty of water, their lips peeling. When they saw anything green, they put it in their mouths and sucked as hard as they could to draw at least a drop of juice. They were exhausted. "There's a pond," Hideo shouted. "Water." They were overjoyed. Hurriedly, they walked toward the pond, but the pond was not there. It was a large blood stain on the ground, and dead bodies were scattered all over the place. They walked back to the rail track, dragging themselves toward the south. As the days passed, they began to see numbers of Koreans or Japanese, children as well as women, walking on the rails. "Hey, are you Japanese or Koreans?" asked one elderly man in Japanese. He walked along with Hideo and his group. "We are Koreans, but not members of the Communist Party," Hideo answered carefully in the Korean language. He was taking every possible precaution. There was a prize for producing anyone on the wanted list, dead or alive. Hideo suspected that Korean communists who had trained in Manchuria were itching to get hold of his father. They would gladly slash the son's head. He would let no one know who he was, lest someone betray him to the communists for a price. "Are you heading for the south?" he asked the old man in Korean. "I am going back to Japan, if I can, that is. Too bad Japan has lost the war." Hideo almost screamed in surprise. "Lost the war? Is the war over? When?" Sochi, Shinzo, and Makoto all looked shocked, but they remained silent, for they did not speak Korean as well as Hideo. "We've been working way up north," he told the man. "The Korean communists attacked us, and we've been walking ever since. I'm heading for Seoul. What day is this?" "The 17th of August," the man spoke in poor Korean. "It's all over. I heard the emperor's talk over the radio." His voice cracked. "And I heard that the Americans dropped powerful bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It's over." Tears streamed like a river on his deeply wrinkled face. Hideo wanted to comfort him, to tell him that he was a Japanese boy. His sadness was great, too. But he held back and stayed cool. "When did the war end?" he asked. 2 days ago. It's all over." They heard more stories. "No wonder everybody is heading southward," Shinzo whispered. "They're getting away from the Korean communists. We've been walking 15 days. They entered a railroad tunnel that became darker and darker. They stumbled on the ties. Hideo and Makoto fumbled for the candles in their rucksacks, and Makoto lit them. The candles gave a faint light, and they carefully went forward. They felt vibrations on the rails. A train! The boys stepped aside, but there was not much space between the rails and the wall of the tunnel. The engine passed by, roaring and shaking the tunnel, and the wind from the train blew out the candles. Hideo pasted himself against the wall and turned his head sideways. He could see sparks from the wheels, and they flew to his legs and hips, and his skin burned. The thick, heavy smoke enveloped the tunnel, and he was unable to breathe or keep his eyes open. He coughed and coughed and felt dizzy. "Is this the end of me?" he thought. Still, he clung to the wall. He heard a sound like something smashing, and at the same time, he felt warm water on his neck and face running down to his chest. At last, the train passed. With deep relief, still coughing, Hideo called his friends' names, and they answered. Again, Makoto lit the candles, and they went on carefully, touching the tunnel wall as a guide, for the candles did not give enough light. Suddenly, Hideo stumbled and fell. Makoto, right behind him, fell too. Both candles went out. "Hey, what's going on? Are you all right?" yelled Shinzo. "I think I stumbled on a human," Hideo replied. Once more, Makoto lit the candles, and there lay the mangled body of the elderly Japanese blocking the track. They were glad when they saw a faint light in the far distance and walked much faster, eager to swallow fresh air. They left the tunnel and took deep breaths. They were all splashed with blood from head to toe, and at first they thought they might be injured, but it was blood splashed from other escapees who could not get out of the way fast enough. Looking for a thicket, they left the track and began wiping off the blood with large leaves. "Halt!" someone shouted in poor Korean. From an opposite thicket, 2 Russian soldiers with machine guns came running. The boys raised their arms high. If there were just 1 soldier, Hideo thought, they could fight him, but there were 2, with weapons. "Are you Korean communist members?" the Russian asked. The boys answered as one. "We are." "Where are you going?" "We are going to Pyongyang," Hideo answered. "Why are you carrying Japanese sacks and blankets?" Hideo lied. "We stole from the Japanese. Our parents got killed. We're heading for our relatives." "Are you all brothers?" one of the soldiers asked. "No, cousins. We are orphans," Hideo made a sad face. The soldiers stared at the boys, and there was silence. Sochi broke the stillness. I have fine cigarettes. Do you smoke?
Where did you get them? A soldier asked.
I stole from the Japanese, answered Sochi. You've never tasted fine cigarettes like these.
He reached to his chest pocket, his right arm still in the air. The soldiers came closer.
Do you have food? Let's exchange, Sochi said.
No, we don't have food. Give me those cigarettes, commanded the head Russian.
Another, close to Sochi, shouted, you stink.
We've not bathed for almost 2 weeks, said Hideo with a little laugh. And then Makoto and Shinzo began to laugh too.
With the laughter, the soldiers seemed to relax. They let the boys bring their arms down.
And as they puffed the fine Japanese cigarettes, the taller soldier said that if they went on to the next town, Tanchon, they would find that the Communist Army headquarters was hiring laborers for little money. If they stayed on, they would be fed.
Tanchon, Hideo thought. They had only walked a fourth of the distance to Seoul. It's a long way to Seoul, but I must make it. Hideo talked to himself in his heart.
Say, comrades, he spoke brightly to the Russian soldiers in Korean. He asked if there was a pond or river nearby, as he wanted to bathe before he met his relatives. The Russian said to walk a couple of miles to the west, and he would cross a little river.
Once more the boys walked. They were thrilled to hear they would find a river, but they did not run or show joyful faces. They walked slowly and composed themselves by singing Korean love songs loudly as they went. The first thing they did when they came to the river was to fill their stomachs with water. They filled their canteens. Then they stripped, washed themselves, and rinsed the Korean clothes borrowed from the Lees. They spread the garments on the riverbank where the sun-heated rocks would dry them, and then they threw themselves on the warm rocks and went to sleep. When they reached the army headquarters in Tanchon, they learned that the labor was putting dead bodies into large straw sacks and tossing them from the cliff into Tanchon Bay. These were bodies that had been thrown from trains or left to die in the fields. At the end of the day, they were given cooked cabbage and rice. Each time, the four boys saved a little, for they knew they had many miles ahead of them. Whenever the boys handled a dead woman or a young girl, they took extra care, sliding the sacks gently down the cliff into the water. Hideo was very relieved that he did not see his mother's or his sister's bodies. When the work was finished, headquarters gave them their small earnings. Then they walked on. They walked for a month and a half until they reached the port city, Wasan. It was the end of September now, and the companions decided to part. Makoto would go with Shinzo and Sochi to their relatives. Hideo would go on to Seoul. He was determined to get at least as far as the 38th parallel, beyond which lay some safety and the hope of meeting his mother and sisters later in Seoul. They cooked the last of their rice and shared the water from the canteens. They lay in the mountain bush, reminiscing about their wonderful friendship.
"Hey," Makoto said, "if we ever get back to Japan, where shall we meet?"
"At Tokyo Bridge. It's a famous meeting spot," Sochi suggested.
"When?" asked Shinzo.
"Maybe 5 years from now," answered Hideo. The stars shone brightly above them, but the breeze from the bay held the smell of fall. None of the four young men could sleep for thinking of this, their last night together. As night advanced, Hideo began to feel chilly, and he spread his little sister's tiny fur coat on his back and covered himself with his blanket. Hideo alone headed toward Seoul next morning. He felt lonesome with no one to talk to, but he kept walking on the railroad tracks, holding the dream that soon he would meet with his mother and sisters.